Chapter 9. Remember the Moon. Good Hunting. Provocateur. A vast dome of coffered glass filled the frontal arc of the vengeful spirit's high-vaulted strategium, through which could be seen the inky blackness of Molech's inner planetary sphere. The few visible points of light were fragile reflections on the armoured hulls of starships of all description and displacement. An armada of conquest attended upon the vengeful spirit surrounding Lupercal's flagship, like prowling pack hunters, as they drew the noose on Molech. Recessed lumen globes bathed the domed chamber in light it had not known since before the war against the Orishian technocracy. A grand Ouslite dais was set at the heart of the strategium, a meter in height, 10 in diameter. It had once been part of Lupercal's court, a meeting table, podium of address, and, in times not so long ago, an altar of sacrifice. To Axamand, it felt like that phase of the Legion's past was simply the first stage of its ongoing transformation, another change he had embraced as surely as he embraced his own autumnal aspect. The last blood spilled on its surface had been that of a supposed ally, an arch schemer and manipulator whose ambitions had finally overstepped his reach. Erebus the Snake, the self-aggrandizing, self-appointed prophet of rebellion, mewling and stripped of flesh and power, the base plotter had fled the vengeful spirit for destinations unknown. Axamand was not sorry to see him go. The bloody trophies and gory window dressing that had attended his teachings were also gone, ripped into the void by the impact of a clayed killer's burning attack ship. Dark-robed Mechanicum adepts and muttering shadow-draped Thalaxii had restored the strategium to its former glory. Where Imperial eagles once glared down at the assembled warriors, now the Eye of Horus observed proceedings. The message was clear. The vengeful spirit was the War Master's ship again, and he its commander. This was a new beginning, a fresh crusade to match the one that had taken them to the very edge of space on a bloodied road of compliant worlds. Lupercal had conquered those worlds once, and he would conquer them again as he forged an Imperium Novus from the ashes of the old. The Murnival stood with their master at the Ouslite dais, lenses cunningly wrought into its upper surfaces, projecting three-dimensional topography of Molech's close-system space. Malagurst tapped the surface of a data slate, and updated icons winked to life. More ships, more defense monitors, more minefields, more void traps, more neutron snares, more orbital defense platforms. "It's a mess," said Axamand. "Lots of ships," agreed Abaddon with relish. "You're already thinking of how to get close enough to storm them, aren't you?" said Axamand. "I already know how," said the first captain. "First, we..." Horus held up a gauntleted hand to forestall the first captain's stratagem. "Take pause, Ezekiel," said Horus. "You and Axamand are old hands at this, and breacher work barely tests your sword arms. Let's assay the temper of the new blood you've added to the mix." Noctua and Kyber straightened as Horus gestured towards the garlanded orb of Molech at the center of the illumined display. "You're no strangers to a broil of swords and bolters, but show me how you'd crack Molech's girdle." As Axamand expected, it was Kyber who spoke first. He leaned into the projection and swept a hand out to encompass the orbital weapon platforms with their racks of torpedoes and macro cannons. "A spear tip right through their fleet to the heart of the guns," said Kyber. "An overwhelming assault into the center, hard and fast, with flanking waves to push their ships into the blade of our spear." Axamand was pleased to see Grail Noctua shake his head. "You disagree?" asked Malagurst, also catching the gesture. "In principle, no," said Noctua. Horus laughed. "A politician's way of saying yes. No wonder you like him so much, Mal." "The plan is sound," said Abaddon. "It's what I would do." "Why doesn't that surprise me?" grinned Axamand. "Then let your little sergeant tell us what he would do," grunted Abaddon, his veneer of civility worn thin. Noctua's face was a cold mask. "Ezekiel, I know I'm new in the Murnival, but call me that again, and we're going to have a problem." Abaddon's eyes bored into Noctua, but the first captain was aware enough to know he'd crossed a line. With the War Master at his side, Abaddon could afford to be gracious without loss of face. "Apologies, brother," he said. I'm too long in the company of the Justerian to remember my manners. Go on. How would you improve the Widowmaker's gambit? Noctua inclined his head, satisfied his point had been made, but savvy enough to understand that he had strained the bounds of his new position. Axemand wondered whether the Mournival had become so fraught that a warrior needed to watch words to his brothers. The answer readily presented itself. Since the two whose names could never be voiced had upset a balance so natural none of them even understood it existed. Noctua took the data slate from Malagurst and scanned its display. His eyes darted between its contents and the holographics. Axemand liked his thoroughness. It matched his own. Well, said Horus, Lev Goshen tells me you have a bold voice, Grail. Use it. Illuminate us. The moon, said Noctua with a feral wolf's grin. I'd remember the moon. Molech's Enlightenment was a fast ship, the fastest in the fleet, its captain liked to boast. Given the slightest encouragement, Captain Argon would extol the virtues of his vessel. A Cobra-class destroyer with engines barely 30 years out of an overhaul and a highly trained and motivated crew. More importantly, the Enlightenment had tasted blood, which was more than could be said for most of the Battlefleet Molech's warships. Captain Argon had fought Xenos Reavers and opportunistic pirate cutters operating out of the mid-system asteroid belt for years. He was the right blend of aggression and competence. And best of all, he was lucky. How are you looking, Mr. Cairo? Said Argon, reclining on his captain's throne and tapping out updated command notes on an inset data slate. Behind him, junior ratings tore off order scrolls from chattering auto-writers and hurried to carry them out. No change in bearing, speed or formation, Captain, replied Lieutenant Cairo from his position overseeing the combat Auspex teams. Vanguard in force, 7 vessels at least. The rest of the fleet is following in a gradually widening gun line with its bulk carriers and Titan landers tucked in behind. Looks like a rolling planetary englobement. Argon grunted and looked up at the viewing bay, a flattened, steel-rimmed ellipse fed positional data by banked rows of implanted servitors. Standard Legion tactics, then, he said, almost disappointed. I expected more of the War Master. The rotating sphere of the engagement volume filled the viewing bay, lit with identifier icons and scrolling data streams. Some captains liked to see open space, but to Argon's way of thinking, that had always seemed utterly pointless. Given the distances involved in Void War, the most a captain might see, if he was lucky, were flickering points of light that vanished almost as soon as they became visible. He magnified the representation of the battlescape. Signifier runes had identified most of the vessels in the oncoming fleet. Death Guard and Sons of Horus. Neither legion was noted for subtlety. Both were renowned for ferocity. It was upon this latter characteristic that Admiral Brython's provocateur strategy hinged. The Enlightenment led a racing fleet of 6 fast-attack vessels, and it was their task to seduce the traitors into the teeth of the orbital platforms. There you are, said Argon, picking out the crimson sigil representing the vengeful spirit, and feeling a thrill of anticipation travel the length of his augmetic spine. The Enlightenment and its accompanying ships were far beyond the reach of the orbital guns. They were exposed, but Argon wasn't worried. He'd heard Tyana Kurion say that to see the legions at war was to witness gods of battle, but that was typical army nonsense. In the void, a warrior's prowess counted for nothing. A lance strike or a torpedo detonation would kill a legionary just as easily as a deck menial, and any captain careless enough to let a space marine ship get close enough to launch a boarding action deserved everything they got. Time to firing range. 8 minutes. 8 minutes, aye, said Argon, opening a vox link to the rest of the provocateur force. All captains, my compliments, said Argon. Begin your launch sequences for prow torpedoes. Full spread. And good hunting. Torpedoes in the void, said Malagurst, watching as holographic salvos crawled across the plinth's display. Time to impact? Asked Horus. Do you really need me to tell you, sir? No, but do it anyway, said Horus. They're playing their role, so let's allow them to think we're playing ours. Malagurst nodded and estimated the travel time of the enemy torpedoes. I make it 97 minutes. Actually, it's 95, said Horace, steepling his fingers and watching the inexorable unfolding of the battle before him. 95, aye, said Malagust, as the battle cogitators confirmed the War Master's calculation. Forgive me, sir. It's been a while since I've needed to work deck duty. It's not a task for which I have any enthusiasm. Horace waved away Malagust's apology and nodded in agreement. Yes, I've always hated void war over other forms of battle. And yet, as in all forms of war, you excel at it. A commander shouldn't be so far removed from the surging ebb and flow of combat, said Horace, as if Malagust hadn't spoken. I am a being wrought for war on a visceral scale, where force and mass and courage are death's currency. I almost miss it sometimes, replied Malagust. The simplicity of an open battlefield, a loaded bolt gun in my hand and an enemy in front of me to kill. It's been a long time since anything was that simple, Mal. If it ever was. There's truth in that, agreed Horace. There's truth in that, indeed. Another truth of Void War was that until warships came together in murderous congress, there was very little to do but wait. The closure speeds of the opposing vanguards were enormous, but so too were the distances between them. But when the dying began, it began quickly. Multiple salvos of ordnance erupted from both vanguard fleets, each torpedo 50 meters in length and little more than a huge rocket booster capped with an extraordinarily lethal warhead. As scores of torpedoes surged from their launch tubes, barrages of armor-penetrating shells blasted from prow batteries. Each volley was silent in the void, but brutalizing echoes reverberated through every gun deck like the pounding drumbeats of titanic slave overseers, deafening those not already insensate to the unending clamor. Glimmering plasma trails intersected between the fleets, then split apart as they hunted for targets. First blood went to the Enlightenment, a spiraling torpedo launched from its starboard launch tubes by Master Gunner Vortin and his 70-strong munition crew, smashed through the armor plating of the Sons of Horus frigate, Raksha. The impact triggered a secondary engine within the torpedo that hurled the main payload deeper into the guts of its target. Like an arena killer whose blade finds a crack in his opponent's armor, the torpedo ripped through dozens of bulkheads before its primary warhead exploded in the heart of the starship. Raksha's keel snapped in two, and over a quarter of its 700 crew members were immolated in a storm of atomic fire. Sheets of armor plating blew out like billowing sailcloth in a storm. Pressurized oxygen burned with brief intensity as compartment after compartment was vented to the void. The debris of the frigate's demise continued moving forward in an expanding cone of tumbling iron, like buckshot from an armsman's shot cannon. The Imperial destroyer, Implacable Resolve, took the next hits, a torpedo to its rear quarter and a lance strike that sheared off its command tower. The vessel broke formation in a veering yaw, spewing a comet's tail of debris and vented plasmic fumes. Without captain or command deck to correct her course, the ship fell from the vanguard until the raging hull fires finally reached the ventral magazines and blew it apart in a seething fireball. Three more vessels were crippled in quick succession: Divine Right, Chthonia Rising, and Reaper of Barbarus. A pair of fist-to-finger impacts penetrated the Imperial vessel's prow armor, and a super-hot plasma jet roared the length of its long axis. Gutted by searing fires, Divine Right exploded moments later as its weapon stores cooked off. The Death Guard destroyer was reduced to a radioactive hulk and critical reactor emissions that lit up the Imperial threat auspex like a beacon fire. The Sons of Horus frigate simply vanished, dead in the water, as its power and life-supporting mechanisms failed in the first instant of impact. Both vanguards had been savaged, but the traitor ships had taken the worst of the engagement. Four vessels remained battle-worthy in the War Master's vanguard, though all had taken hits in the opening shots of the engagement. Their captains were hungry for blood, and they fired their ships' engines, eager to tear into the enemy at close range. Behind them, the fleets of the Death Guard and Sons of Horus followed suit. Battle would be joined, and the dead avenged. The Imperial ships would learn what it meant to face the War Master. But Battlefleet Molech had no intention of going head-to-head with a vastly superior fleet. No sooner had the ordnance struck the traitor vanguard than Captain Argon issued orders to turn the provocateur fleet around. His remaining ships raced back to Molech and the cover of its orbital weapon platforms. And just as Lord Admiral Semper had planned, the bloodied fleet of the War Master gave chase. "Remember the moon," he says, grunted Abaddon, as if any Chthonian even took part in that fight. Unable to make any sound within the frozen vacuum of the tomb ship, the First Captain's voice sounded in Kallus Ekadon's helmet over the Vox. He didn't answer. Strict Vox silence protocols were in force, but when had something as trivial as a direct order from the War Master troubled Ezekiel Abaddon? "Remember the moon," repeated Abaddon. "For 200 years we've tried to forget the moon." On the flag bridge of the Guardian of Aquinas, Lord Admiral Brython Semper watched the unfolding engagement in the central hololith with a measured sense of satisfaction. He paced with his hands laced behind his back. A cohort of 9 phalacs followed him on hissing, piston-driven legs, the low hum of their lightning guns ruffling hairs on the back of his neck. At least, he told himself, it was their strange weaponry. Semper didn't like the blank-faced cybernetics, as it always unnerved him to know there was some scrap of a living being within that sarcophagus armor. Still, at least they didn't speak unless you spoke to them, unlike Proximo Tarkon of the vessel's assigned complement of ultramarines, who proffered unasked-for tactical advice like he were the one who'd spent most of his life aboard a warship. Tarkon was only a centurion for throne's sake, but still he acted as though the Guardian of Aquinas was his own legion warship. To the Mechanicum and the fleet, Semper's flagship was an Avenger-class grand cruiser, which captured something of the vessel's majesty, but nothing of its savagery. A part of the Guardian's crew since his recruitment on Cypra Mundi, Brython Semper knew just how ferocious a machine of war it was. Its mode of attack was not subtle. It owed nothing to finesse and was bloody in the way 2 starving rats locked in a box was bloody. Guardian of Aquinas was a gunboat, a sledgehammer vessel that waited for the enemy line to widen before surging into the gap and unleashing hellish broadsides from multiple gun decks. "Good hunting indeed, Argon," hissed Semper as the wounded vessels of the Provocateur fleet limped back into range of the orbital weapons platform. "Gave those traitor bastards a bloody nose and then some. By Mars and all his red blades, you did!" That was overstating the damage caused by the Provocateur fleet, but his lavish estimation of it would fire the blood of his crew. The Thalax straightened at the mention of the red planet. In pride, or some conditioned reflex, he couldn't tell. As impressive as Argon's attack had been, it was just the prelude to the real fight. Semper cast his critical gaze over the disposition of his fleet, and was content. 42 Imperial vessels were spread between 3 attack formations, a strong centre of frigates and destroyers with fast-attack cruisers on the flanks. 2 Gothics sailed abeam of the flagship, the Admonishment in fire and the Solar's Glory. Both had fought in the reclamation of the birth system, and, like the Guardian of Aquinas, they were line-breakers, armed with broadside lances that were sure to wreak fearful havoc among the traitor ships. Sailing in the leftmost battlegroup was Semper's mailed fist. Adranus was a dominator, and its Nova cannon was going to create the gap Semper and the Gothics would rip wide open. The combined Sons of Horus and Death Guard fleets were in wrathful pursuit of the vessels that had hurt them. As Argon had communicated, the enemy fleets were moving to englobe Molech, but retained a center mass to engage the orbital defenses and battlefleet Molech. Semper saw a textbook planetary assault formation, one any first-year cadet would recognize from the works of De Ruyter, Duilius, or Yi Sun Shin. "They must not think very highly of us to come at us with so basic an attack," said Semper, loud enough for the deck crews to hear. "So much for Captain Salakar's fears of us being outfought." Yet for all his outward bluster, Semper was under no illusions that the enemy approaching Molech was supremely dangerous. He'd studied the War Master's tactics during the Great Crusade. His assaults were brutal, without mercy, and the enemy almost never saw their doom coming. This assault felt almost comically simple and direct. What was he not seeing? The War Master's fleets would be in range of the orbitals at his back in less than 3 minutes. The hololith flickered with confirmed firing solutions received from their master gunners. He'd already authorized captain's discretion for each of the platform's commanders. They knew their trade and needed no direction from him to punish the traitors. Yet the nagging doubt that wormed its way into his thoughts at the sight of so basic an assault formation wouldn't go away. What am I missing? Platform Master Panrick had a surfeit of weapons aboard the Varson orbital station. Torpedo racks, missile tubes, close-range defense cannon, ion shields, mass drivers, and battery after battery of macro cannons. All were eager to be unleashed. "Weapon systems at full readiness," reported the deck officer. "Command authority transfer on your mark." Panrick nodded. They'd achieved full readiness a little slower than he'd have liked. Still within acceptable tolerances, so no sense in making a scene just now. "Mark," said Panrick, inserting the silver command ring on his right index finger into the slot on his throne. He turned and subvocally recited his authority signifiers. Clamps locked his neck in place, and a whirring, rotating connector plug slotted into the mind impulse unit socket drilled through into his spine. Information flooded him. Every surveyor and auspex on the great crescent-shaped platform was now his to access. His organic vision faded, replaced with a sensorium suite of approach vectors, closure speeds, deflection angles, and targeting solutions. In a very real sense, Panrick became orbital platform Varson. A potent sense of might surged through him. Connection burn and inload surge made him wince. But it faded as cognition-enhancing stims flooded his thalamus and occipital lobe. Implanted vents at the back of Panrick's skull opened, allowing the heat generated by his overclocked brain to dissipate. "I have command authority, I," repeated Panrick, alternating between the local auspex and the feed coming in from the attack logistas of the Guardian of Aquinas. The enemy fleet was coming in hard and fast, looking to roll straight over the orbital defences and break through before suffering too much damage. A bold strategy, but a risky one. Too risky, thought Panrick, glancing down at the staggered line of orbitals and the haze of minefields strung between them like glittering jewels. Panrick cricked his neck and flexed his fingers. Weapon systems armed in response. "Come ahead, then," he said to the advancing fleets. "Give it your best shot." 0012. Axiomand watched the mottled grey and green marble of Molech rotate below him. Close. So very close. Ice limned the kinetic bracing, and frost webbed the plate of his fellow warriors. For the last 16 hours, he'd been watching the timer in the corner of his visor count down to zero. 0009. Inaction didn't suit him. It didn't suit any of them, but he at least had learned to deal with it. Ezekiel and Falcus were prowling hounds who savoured the swift kill. Not for them, the patient hunt. In contrast, Axiomand was a bowstring that lost nothing of its power by being kept taut. Yet even he'd found this long, frozen vigil testing. 0005. Nocturne, he suspected, could outlast them all. Axiomand almost smiled as he wondered how long it had taken before Ezekiel broke the Vox Silence protocol. Not long. He'd be too full of hubris to resist letting his mouth run away from him. Axiomand remembered the tales of the moon's fall. 0002. He remembered chimeric monsters of the Selenar cults, gene-spliced bioweapons, killing machines of flesh and acid and gibbering insanity. He remembered tales of slaughter, unrestrained, wild, savage, and yet to be tempered by Lupercal's discipline. But most of all was the cry of surrender, "Call off your wolves!" 0000. "Spear tip," said Axiomand. "Light them up." "Contacts!" shouted the deck officer. Panrick had seen them no more than a fraction of a second before, but had disregarded them due to their position behind and below Varson. They were faint, no more than flickers. They couldn't possibly be hostile. But they were growing stronger with every passing moment.
"Malfunctioning mines," suggested the Auspex Master, "or hyper-accelerated debris caught in the flare of a surveyor sweep."
Panrick didn't need cognition-enhancing drugs to hear the desperate hope in the man's voice. He knew fine well what these returns were. He just didn't know how the hell they'd gotten there.
"Tomb ships! Thrown! They're tomb ships!" said the Auspex Master. "I've heard of the tactic, but thought it was just a myth." What in the name of Hellblade's balls are tomb ships?
Tomb ships, repeated the Auspex Master. Vessels shot into the void and then completely shut down, emptied of atmosphere and left to fly towards their target. There's no power emissions, so they're virtually impossible to detect until they fire up their reactors. It's also next to impossible to pull off.
Clearly not impossible enough, said Panric, each dart of his ocular implant shifting fire priorities. Retask batteries, Theta, through Lambda, to low orbit echelon fire. Atmospheric bursts only. I don't want any of our munitions hitting the surface. Ventral torpedo bays recalculate firing solutions. And someone, get me the Lord Admiral.
Two ships were right on top of him, a dozen more spread behind the network of orbital platforms. They'd appeared from nowhere. The surveyor returns from their hulls growing stronger as dormant reactors were quick cycle to readiness and targeting Auspex trawled his platform for weak points. He felt the shudder of point-blank torpedo impacts on the hull through the mind impulse unit link with Varson's surface systems. He grimaced in sympathetic pain. Armor penetrators, not explosive warheads. The sensorium came alive with hull breach warnings and system failures as the newly revealed ships lashed them with terrifyingly accurate gunfire. Varson's defense systems blew apart one by one.
They mean to board us, he said, with a sick jolt of horror.
This was just the fight he was bred for. Head hunched low behind a breacher's shield, moving forward, Mornit All's enhanced edge cutting through meat and bone and armor with ease. The boarding torpedo smoked and howled in the splintered underside of the orbital plate. Melting ice streamed from its superheated hull, and Sons of Horus breachers poured from its interior. The rapid reaction force sent to intercept them were dead. Exo-armored mortals, highly trained and well-armored, now nothing more than offal and butcher meat scattered like abattoir refuse. Yade Durso, second captain of the 5th Company, together with 5 warriors in heavily reinforced battle plate and shields, formed a wedge with him at its point. Tactical overlays appeared on his visor, schematics, objectives, kill boxes. Another timer. This one even more crucial than the last. Remember the moon, Grail Noctua had said. Axeman threw back his head and howled and let raw savagery take him. A flicker of Ignis Fatuus was the first warning. Crackling blue teleport flare arced between the primary stanchions of the Varzerba orbital plate's command center. Ear canals cracked in the seconds before a hard bang of displaced air shattered every data slate within 20 meters of the translock point. Ezekiel Abaddon, Kalos Ekadon, and 6 Justerian stood in an outward-facing ring, their armor glossy and black, trailing vapor ghosts of teleporter flare. A hooded priest of the Mechanicum stood in the center of the ring of Terminators, a hunched thing of multiple limbs, glowing eye lenses, and hissing pneumatics. The junior officers barely had time to register the presence of the hulking killers before a blitzing storm of combi bolter fire mowed them down.
"Kill them all!" said Abaddon.
The Justerians spread out, spewing shots that looked indiscriminate, but were in fact preternaturally exact. The War Master's orders had been unambiguous. The defense platforms were to be captured intact. Within moments, it was done. Abaddon marched to the throne at the heart of the control center. A mewling wretch sat there, soiled and weeping. His eyes were screwed shut, as if that would save him. Abaddon broke his neck and wrenched the limp sack of bones from the throne without bothering to undo the neck clamp. The platform master's head tore off and bounced over the deck before coming to rest by an armaments panel.
You! Barked Abaddon, waving the Mechanicum priest forward. Sit your ass down and get this thing shooting!
The fight through the Mausolytica had been bloody, but its outcome had, knew Grail Noctua, been a foregone conclusion. The fight through the heart of Var Crixia was just the same. Its defenders were well-trained, well-armed, and disciplined. But they had never fought transhumans before. The Warlocked were eternal, a squad never omitted from the 25th Company's order of battle. Death occasionally altered its composition, but a line of continuity could be traced from its current makeup all the way back to its inception.
knocked you a fort along the starboard axial, a gently curved transit way that ran from one tip of the crescent-shaped station to the other. Herringbone passageways branched from the main axial like ribs, and it was from these raked corridors that exo-armored mortals were attempting to hold them off. It wasn't working. Breachers went in hard and fast, running at the low crouch. Shields up, heads down, bolters locked into the slotted upper edge. Braying streaks of miniature rockets rammed down the main axial, killing anything that dared to show itself. Automated gun carriages pummeled the advancing legionaries, but were quickly bracketed and shredded by bolter fire. Static emplacements unmasked from ceiling mounts and hidden wall caskets. Grenade dispensers dumped frags and crack bombs. Battle plate withstood the bulk of it. Legion warriors stomped on through the acrid broil of aerosolized blood and yellow smoke. Noctua advanced behind the wall of shields, bolter pulled in tight to his shoulder. Ahead, a barricade of hard plasteel and light-distorting refractors extruded from a choke point in the corridor. Bulky shapes moved through the haze. Sawing blasts of autocannon fire punched into shields, ceramite and steel splintered. Other weapons fired, louder, harder, and with a bigger, more lethal muzzle sound. A legionary grunted in pain as a shot found a gap in the shields and blew out his kneecap. Mass reactives. The shell ricocheted from hardened bone and travelled down the length of the warrior's shin. It detonated at his ankle and obliterated his foot. Trailing the shredded remains on a rope of mangled tendons like a grotesque form of penitentiary ball and chain, the warrior kept up with his fellow shield-bearers. Over the upper edges of the shields, Noctua saw hints of the defenders. It was like looking through a pane of fat, smeared glass. They were big, bigger than even the largest mortal exosuit, and Noctua was confused until chance light through the refractors granted him a fleeting impression of cobalt blue and gold plate. An Ultima rendered in mother of pearl.
"Legion foe!" he shouted. "Ultramarines!"
Another volley of hard, echoing shots. Two of the breachers went down, one with the back of his helm a smoking, ruined crater, the other with his head lolling over his back and his throat blown out to the spine. The advance faltered, but didn't stop. Legionaries, following behind, swept up the fallen shields and dressed ranks. One died before he could bring the shield up completely, his shoulders and ribs separated by a pair of bolter shells. Another pitched over without a head, as a round slotted neatly through the bolter notch. Noctua took his turn, bending to grab the shield before it hit the ground. A shot punched the lip of the shield, and he felt the blazing edge of the shell score a line across his brow where his Mournival mark was graven. He slid home his bolter.
"Onwards," he said. "We stop, we die."
Gunshots sounded from one of the herringbone corridors. Stubber fire, cannon blasts, and wickering volleys of flechettes. Pin us in place with legion forces, then overwhelm us with mortal units shooting from the flanks and rear. Clever. Practical. They could fight their way clear. Retreat. Regroup. Find a workaround. But that would take time. Time the fleet didn't have if it wasn't going to be savaged by Var Crixia's guns. No. Retreat wasn't an option. Suddenly, it didn't need to be. An ululating howl came from one of the herringbone corridors, and a pack of dark-armored warriors charged into the fray. They moved like sprinting acrobats, using the walls as well as the deck to propel themselves forward. They hit the barricade like a shell from a demolisher cannon, smashing it to splinters with the ferocity of impact. Some fired bolters and wielded blades. Others simply tore into their foes with what looked like implanted claws. Blood arced up in cataclysmic geysers, and the savagery was beyond anything Noctua had ever seen. Refractors blew out with squalling shrieks, and what had previously been hidden was now revealed. Noctua had thought his reinforcements to be another squad of the 25th Company, but such was not the case. They were still Sons of Horus, or had been once. Their armor was a mix of swamp green, soot black, and flaked blood. Some went without helms, their faces protean and scabbed with wounds cut into their faces. The stench of burned meat attended them, and though the refractors were no more, Noctua still felt as though the air between them was somehow polluted. Inhuman strength, beyond even that of a transhuman, tore the ultramarines apart.
Limbs were rent from shoulder guards, clawed fists punched through plastrons and thickly muscled hearts ripped from splintered rib sheaths. Noctua watched as one of the smoking warriors twisted a helm from a gorget with the head and spinal column still attached. He swung this like a spike-headed flail, battering another of the 13th Legion to death with it. The warrior spread his arms wide and roared, his maw a red furnace into hell. Scars covered his neck and cheeks, and he bled toxic smoke from two old wounds in his chest. Shock pinned Noctua in place. Gare Garadon, whose fighting days ended on Dwell. Noctua's eyes met those of Garadon, and he saw madness behind that gaze, malignant fire and a soul that burned in its chains. The moment lasted an instant only, and Noctua threw off his horror at what Garadon had become. The Ultramarines were dead, no longer a threat. Time to deal with the enemies that were. "Come about!" ordered Noctua, and the shields lifted high, their bearers turning on the spot as the warriors behind them pushed past. In one fluid manoeuvre, the entire formation of the Warlocked was reversed. Bolter fire flayed the mortal soldiers, and they balked in the face of sudden reversal. With their legion allies dead, the mortals knew that the fight was over, and fled. It went against the grain to let them go, but this plan was of his devising, and he was already behind. Var Crixia's guns needed to be firing at the right targets. Noctua turned to see what Gare Garadon and his warriors were doing, reluctant to let them out of his sight even for a second. They were on their knees, feasting on the ultramarines they had killed.